The 13th congressional district race in Illinois is drawing national attention and money. Plus, students and staff at universities around the state have been told to return home over fears of the coronavirus. We'll hear from Bradley University and a regional airport about steps they're taking to prevent the spread of the illness. And there are hundreds of thousands of coyotes here in Illinois. That includes urban and suburban areas. Experts say we need to learn to coexist.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
I'm Jenna Dooley. Stay tuned. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. Coming up this hour, the coronavirus has spread to more than 70 countries. There have been a handful of cases reported here in Illinois. We'll hear how it's affected travel plans for people in the state, and we'll check in with a virologist. But first, it's Super Tuesday, and the state's casting ballots today contain 40% of the U.S. population. Illinois is not one of them. Our state holds its primary March 17th. Still, from congressional races to the presidential race, money is pouring in on all sides from now until November. In Illinois, one of the most competitive and costly races is in Illinois' 13th congressional district. WGLT reporter Ryan Denham has been covering the candidates in this race, and he joins us now for more. Also, we have Kent Redfield. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Science with the Institute for Legal, Legislative, and Policy Studies at the University of Illinois Springfield. He also wrote the book. It's called Money Counts: How Dollars Dominate Illinois Politics and What We Can Do About It. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jenna.
Ryan, can you remind us a bit about the 13th district, where it is, what it looks like geographically and demographically?
Well, first things first, it's huge. It covers a large chunk of Illinois, including Bloomington Normal, or parts of Bloomington Normal, Springfield, Decatur, parts of Champaign, Urbana. It's a really interesting mix of like white-collar communities, college towns like Bloomington Normal, where you've got a headquarters of State Farm, but also a lot of rural areas that would have been pretty hard hit by the trade disputes that have been going on. The district voted for President Trump by 5 percentage points last time around. Romney won the district pretty narrowly back in 2012, so it is comfortably a swing district.
Ryan, who are the candidates this time around?
So Congressman Rodney Davis is the Republican incumbent who's had the seat for a while. The two Democrats who are on the ballot facing off in the primary are Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan of Springfield. She was the nominee back in 2018, and she lost pretty narrowly to Davis that time around. And the second Democrat in the race this time around is a relative newcomer, a first-time candidate for office, Stephanie Smith of Urbana, who is sort of trying to flank Londrigan from the left, a little bit more left-leaning on several issues, including health care.
Ryan, one more before we head over to Kent. We want to talk about fundraising. You recently looked into the Federal Election Commission filings for these candidates. Ryan, how much money has gone into this race?
Quite a bit. So Londrigan, who is the Democrat, has over $1 million in cash on hand as of the last filing deadline, slightly ahead of where Davis, the incumbent, is. And there is just a lot of money even flowing in from out of state that makes this race pretty notable. What I found interesting was that to kind of compare where Londrigan was 2 years ago versus where she is today from a fundraising perspective. So to put it in that context, Londrigan has like almost five times as much money in the bank as she had this time 2 years ago. And that was ahead of 2 years ago, she was up against a five-way Democratic primary. So, it's interesting how it's shaking out.
Ryan, you touched on some of the numbers from this race compared to the previous time. Kent Redfield, what observations have you had about how the numbers compare to where this race in the 13th Congressional District was in 2018?
Well, because neither one of them actually has a serious challenge, you're going to see less spending, after we get through the primary, and they won't. The urgency of them raising money, isn't as great as if they faced either one of them facing a primary. You're going to see a lot of money come into this district from outside sources that are not going to be run through the campaign. So 2 years ago, the two of them together spent $7.8 million of money that they raised themselves, but there was another $6 million that came in from super PACs that are basically representing Democrat or Republican interests and to some extent business and labor. So what was a 13, $14 million race 2 years ago is likely to be at least that expensive and maybe more so with, 40% of the money perhaps coming in from outside groups because this is a seat that can flip. Last time around, it didn't flip. The Republican Rodney Davis retained the seat, but two seats up in the suburbs went from Republican to Democrat. And so Illinois has three districts that potentially could change hands. And so we're going to see a lot of outside money because all of these are critical for controlling the House. The Republicans are not likely to take back control of the House if they end up losing Rodney Davis. That would be a very bad sign. So it's not just people in the 13th district, but there really is a national audience where this money is coming from.
Ryan, according to the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, that 13th congressional district is a toss-up, like Kent mentioned. It could go either way. One of the few in Illinois. Why do you think it's become so competitive?
Well, I mean, a couple of reasons come to mind, and Ken may have additional thoughts, but the district is drawn to be competitive. You know, districts in Illinois are drawn by the majority party, that being the Democrats. And so the district is meant to give Democrats a shot at it, even if it is, a pretty conservative place. Another reason is that, President Trump is going to be on the ballot in 2020, and he was not in 2018. So that may tighten things up a little bit.
Kent, why do you think the 13th has become so competitive?
Well, I think, it's exactly correct that it was drawn to be a district that or the Democrats in the right year with the right candidate might be competitive. And it does reflect a lot of national politics. It is, as we were talking about earlier, it has a mixture of urban and college towns, rural areas, the effect of the trade dispute with China, and the continuing issue of health care are things that were big issues in 2 years ago. They're going to continue to be big issues. And so, you're playing out the national conflict. That's being reflected in this district. Lots of other districts in Illinois are overwhelmingly Democrat or overwhelmingly Republican, and it's the few areas that are swing districts that both you've got the national issues and then you've got the national money because you see an opportunity to make a difference rather than contributing to somebody you agree with in another district, but they have no chance of winning.
Kent, historically speaking, do you know how the district was drawn that way? Has it always been competitive like this?
When we did it changes every 10 years, and so the previous map was essentially an incumbent protection map. And so my city, Springfield, was actually had three congressional districts because Lane Evans, the Democratic congressman who was in the Quincy area, he had his district went all the way over to Decatur. When they drew the new district, the assumption on the Democrats' part was that the Metro East district would stay Democratic because there was a congressman named Costello, and they expected his son to run in that district. He didn't, and it flipped Republican, but this district was drawn again. The idea was if you're going to get a Democrat in central Illinois, then you've got to capture as many Democratic votes as possible, and that's why you've got Bloomington, Normal, Champaign, Springfield, goes all the way down to Edwardsville and Madison, Madison County. So you're always making, when you draw these maps, you're trying to project. And I think, downstate Illinois has trended much more conservative than the Democrats thought. And so this is a tough thing for Lonergan to win. It's going to be very close. And it's really, we're either going to have one Democratic congressman from downstate or two. Sherry Boustros will probably retain her seat. But
she's a very moderate Democrat.
Right. But in the suburbs, two districts that were drawn, assuming they would elect Republicans, and so they drew them in ways to make other districts more favorable to Democrats, two districts flipped in the suburbs. So when you draw maps, you're always kind of guessing, what are the demographic trends going to be for the next decade? And it turned out that downstate is more conservative than people thought it would be, and the suburbs have shifted more to the left. And
well, I think that would be Lauren Underwood winning.
Lauren Underwood and Kass. So Peter Roskin and Holgren were the two Republicans, and everybody assumed, that those were safe districts, and they turned out not to be in a year when the Democrats had all of the momentum. We'll see who has the momentum in this election.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois Springfield, and Ryan Denham, a reporter at WGLT in Normal. Ryan, has the competitiveness of this race brought in money? Well, actually, I should say, where has the money been coming from?
Yeah, interesting. That was something we've been paying a lot of attention to at WGLT. So for Lonergan, the Democrat from Springfield, she's relying more on individual contributions. So 80% of her money going directly to her has come from individual contributors. Only two-thirds of that money has come from Illinois. So you've got a bunch of money coming in from California, Massachusetts, Missouri, New York. And on Davis's side of the fence, he's relying less on individual contributors. Incumbents can attract sort of larger PAC dollars. So he's relying less on individual contributors, but those who are giving money individually, about 60% of that is coming from Illinois residents. So a fair amount for both of them coming from out of state.
Well, Kent, you did write the book called Money Counts, How Dollars Dominate Illinois Politics and What We Can Do About It. You wrote that back in 2000, but it says what we can do about it. So I want to open this up to you, Kent. If there is so much money going into the races, the so what?
Well, there are two issues there, at least two. I mean, one of them is just the because of how the system has opened up, the opportunity for very wealthy individuals either to run or to finance super PACs. And so you've got a lot of really big money coming in and much more corporate money because of the Citizens United decision. And then when races get nationalized, then sometimes, as they do in these competitive ones where the two parties are going to be providing, 40-50% of the money. Then you start to have races that are the race up in the sixth district, which was the Kasten Rothman race, was $24 million. So you're starting to have so much money there that often the local interests get lost, that the concentration is more on on the big issues and what people are, the problems of the specific issues of the district sometimes get lost when these contests become nationalized. So, you want to elect people that know your interests, that are going to represent you, and often these get to be fights between huge money interests and political parties, that are thinking nationally rather than locally.
Ryan, as you're conveying this information and covering the candidates for your audience, how are you, why do you think it's important for your audience to know the money that's going in the race behind their issues?
I think it's just an indicator of how important it is to the rest of the country. I think we can look at a congressional race and, it's got a small part of Bloomington-Normal, for example, included, but to sort of be able to look at our local member of Congress in a national perspective is really important. So many of the stories that we hear on public radio or whatever are coming from Congress, right? And it's, national deliberations on this or that issue. But this is an example where national issues are being shaped right in our backyards. And this is a pretty premier congressional race in that context.
That's Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at University of Illinois Springfield, and you just heard from Ryan Denham, a reporter with WGLT, which is within the 13th Congressional District. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Certainly.
Coming up after the break, we know O'Hare has been screening some international travelers to stop the spread of the coronavirus. But what are smaller regional airports doing in Illinois? We'll hear from the director of the Peoria Airport. That's next on the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. The 2019 coronavirus has now spread to 71 countries and infected more than 92,000 people. This has, of course, affected travel plans for some in Illinois. Students at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois State University have been instructed to come home because of worries over the coronavirus in places like Italy and South Korea. And Bradley University in Peoria also notified students that they must return home from Rome, Florence, and Milan. Joining us now on the line is Nathan Thomas, VP of Student Affairs at Bradley University in Peoria. Nathan, welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And many of those students returning home will be traveling to the Peoria International Airport. Gene Olson is the Director of Airports for the Metropolitan Airport Authority of Peoria. He's with us now as well. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me also.
To start with Nathan, why did you make the decision to have students at Bradley return home?
Well, our recommendation to our students specifically in Italy is that we recommend that they return. And it's really out of an abundance of caution for their well-being. And if you think about how potentially traumatic it could be if you were abroad, away from family and those networks that you have, of what that impact may be to the student. On top of, we've been in tremendous communication with the affiliate programs that our students are part of, and they have either canceled those programs completely or provided online alternatives for our students. So there's abilities for them to complete their coursework in alternative manners than being presently face-to-face.
Nathan, how many students do you have abroad right now?
We have 36 students in 15 different countries at this point.
Gene, some of those students returning home will likely go through O'Hare or Dallas, but their final destination may be through the Peoria International Airport. We know that O'Hare has been screening passengers from some countries. How has your airport changed its processes?
Well, we haven't really changed anything directly. Our posture at this point is monitoring all the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and making sure that, you know, that we are abreast of everything that's going on. But as far as changing any direct procedures or anything like that, we haven't been asked to do that, and there's no guidance out there suggesting that we do that. In fact, it's kind of, you know, the opposite, because the, you know, the chance, because of the way, this is even on the CDC website, the chance, the way air is filtered through an airliner, it gets recirculated and filtered very frequently. So the chances of actually catching a COVID-19 infection while you're on a plane is pretty low. We do have hand sanitizers, dispensers scattered throughout the airport on both the public side and on the secured side. But that's not new. We've had that since before I came to work here in 2009.
So most of the guidance that you're looking to is Center for Disease Control. Are you looking also, does Illinois Department of Public Health weigh in on Illinois airports?
Not really. Most of our guidance along those lines comes from the County Health Department. We stay in very close contact with them. They participate in all of our emergency planning. You know, we have good contacts with their staff. And just to give you an example, back when MERS was a thing a couple of years ago, there was a patient that traveled through O'Hare and went to, I don't think he even flew, I think he went by surface transportation to somewhere in north central Indiana. And the county health department, you know, they had traced that person back to a flight through O'Hare, and just because of the O'Hare connection, the county health department notified us of that patient. So, you know, it's good communication and a good relationship that we have with them that keeps us apprised of what's going on.
Gene, you brought up MERS. Nathan, I'm wondering, has Bradley ever had to get students to return because of a similar outbreak like this?
I don't believe so, and I've been here at the university for a few years now. I mean, a lot of our preparation goes back to H1N1 about 10-plus years ago, and we're following, similar to Gene, a lot of our protocols that we've had in place for a number of years, and just making sure that they're updated, but also in preparation for what is really an emerging type of guidance, and that we can be responsive as we may need to.
Gene, at the airport, what responsibility do you think airports that are smaller like yours have when it comes to preventing a potential pandemic like coronavirus? I mean, do you feel like you have enough resources from the county or the state?
Well, the resources that we do have are, you know, information resources, and I think that's very good. You know, we're getting information when it becomes available. But in terms of other resources, there's zero. But I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. You know, there's not really a need at this point. All the international arrivals all go through gateway airports and are screened there. So I guess my question would be, resources to do what? Mm-hmm. Because we're not involved in screening passengers. We're not involved in screening visitors. Just the same way that we don't do that for influenza. I don't feel that there aren't any resources, but I don't know that we need them either, because it's all the screenings being done at the bigger gateway airports.
Gene, are you seeing passengers show signs of concern? I mean, are you seeing people come through the gates with face masks, more hand sanitizer, things that they're doing on their own?
It's hard to say whether I'm just noticing it more or whether it's an increased level, but, you know, you see passengers all the time duck over to one of the hand sanitizer dispensers and get a little squirt of that stuff. You see people with, you know, face masks, but not more than you normally would. There's always a certain amount of that. We have, because of kind of our travel patterns and the hubs that we connect to, we do see a significant percentage of our travelers are older folks, and those are the ones you tend to see more with masks, but no different than before the outbreak.
And Nathan, have you heard from the Bradley students or faculty who are abroad now? I mean, when are they expecting to arrive home?
Yeah, we've been in really good communication with our students who are abroad, and some of them have already returned. Others are awaiting flights that may return within the next couple of days. And so we've been, through our study abroad office, been in very consistent communication with them, not only on the alert levels within their countries, but what our recommendations are, and then they've been communicative back to us of what their travel plans are. So we have a pretty good tracking of where exactly our students are and when they're going to be where along their journeys back to.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. We've been speaking with Gene Olson, director of the Peoria International Airport, and Nathan Thomas, who is VP of Student Affairs at Bradley. Bradley, like many colleges around the state, has asked students to return home from countries where there have been a high number of coronavirus cases. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I want to bring in another voice into the conversation here. Chris Brook is an assistant professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
When we say coronavirus, it's not actually one virus. Can you walk us through some of the terminology and distinctions in terms of what we're talking about?
Right. So coronavirus is a broad family of viruses. In fact, lots of different animal species around the world. There are already several coronaviruses that regularly infect humans and sort of fall under the umbrella of common cold viruses. But then there are also some of these viruses that are, naturally infect animals but have gained the ability to move into humans and cause more severe disease. And so SARS coronavirus in 2003, as well as MERS coronavirus since 2012, and now SARS coronavirus 2.
What do we know about how the virus spreads?
Right, so it's almost certainly this virus is spreading via the respiratory route. So that means virus expelled by infected individuals, either by coughing, sneezing, or even normal breath. So virus via the air. It's also, there's a good chance that you can see transmission via contact. And so that means virus deposited on surfaces, door handles, elevator buttons, things like that. That then people touch with their hand and then touch their hand to their nose or their eyes or other mucosal surfaces.
I was just at a big box store and I saw up in the front they had all of the wipes, the sanitation, all of those in front. And then, obviously we're starting to see some images of face masks and things like that. What would be the value of wearing a face mask if you're healthy or using like a Clorox wipes or something, antibacterial wipes around your home? Is that needed now?
Right. So let me talk about the face masks first. So the value of a face mask when you're healthy is zero. It's actually somewhat costly from a broader perspective. So the face masks that you buy in the store are not really going to protect you to any sufficient degree from respiratory viruses. And in fact, they may have some efficacy when you're already sick of limiting the amount of virus that you're expelling, but certainly they're not going to protect you if you're healthy.
Why not?
And just because they don't actually fully block the access of virus within aerosols or respiratory droplets in the air from getting into your respiratory tract. They don't actually seal things off effectively. There are respirators that do that, but these aren't the sort of thing that you pick up at Bed Bath & Beyond. And a more critical issue is that that respirators and face masks are needed by frontline healthcare responders and other healthcare professionals. And we are very concerned about shortages and the availability of these masks. So, healthy people in the community buying these up out of fear increases the chances that there won't be enough of these available for healthcare professionals or other people who are really at the forefront of responding to this virus and are thus at the greatest risk of contracting and transmitting the virus.
So it really does go back to the hand washing?
Right. So hand washing is critical, is the best thing you can do. The other very the other sort of approach that's been shown to be effective in similar situations is what's called social distancing. So really just keeping your distance from other people, that minimizes the chances for, you know, transmission via coughing, sneezing, or breathing. And I think as this virus becomes more widespread in our communities, just minimizing the amount of time you spend around other people, especially in close contact, is one of the best tools that we have for limiting community spread.
And there's going to be some places that are really difficult to do that, places like airports. And we just heard that there's different preventative measures and some places aren't doing preventative things quite yet. Do you agree with what officials in airports have been doing across the country to prevent the spread of the virus? Is there anything else that they could or should be doing?
So, you know, to my understanding, they're following the directions of the Centers for Disease Control and potentially also the WHO, which are in line with each other. And that's absolutely what I would recommend. The Centers for Disease Control is the best resource and has the broadest, deepest amount of expertise in the subject. I would their recommendations would be the gold standard.
How far from a vaccination do you think we are, Chris?
Right. So people are working very hard and very fast on this right now. That being said, it would probably be in the neighborhood of 12 months or more before we have a vaccine that is licensed to go to be used in a widespread fashion. As I understand it, groups including the National Institutes of Health are moving into what are called phase one clinical trials in the next 2 to 3 months. And what that does is basically take candidate vaccines that we think might work and test them in a limited subset of people to make sure that they're safe and that they're well tolerated.
We've gotten comfortable with the flu vaccine. I mean, in terms of you see it at grocery stores, you can get it at, you know, Walgreens or a CVS. If and when a vaccine for coronavirus is readily available, do you imagine it would be a similar thing, or it would just be people among a vulnerable population who would want to make the appointment to get that?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer for it because we don't really know how this virus is going to play out. It remains an open question whether it's going to, spread and eventually die out, or whether it will show a pattern similar to what influenza pandemics have done in the past, where, you know, you have this initial pandemic where a lot of people get infected and sick, and then the virus sort of establishes itself in the human population and becomes a much less severe, more seasonal influenza virus. And so I think it's, you know, it really depends on what this virus does over the next year or two, whether it disappears, whether it continues with the same sort of mortality and morbidity rates, or whether it maintains itself in the population and becomes something much less severe. And so I think based on that, you know, I would recommend following, again, the recommendations of the CDC and WHO when the time comes.
And just finally, since we've got a virologist on the line here, as you're making sense of this in your own personal world, we're inundated with images on social media and so forth, and from reputable news organizations as well. Where do you categorize this?
I would say that it certainly is at, if characterizing it as a pandemic is certainly a reasonable thing to do. And I expect that we're going to see case numbers and deaths in the United States increasing substantially as we gain the ability to actually test for this virus. I think right now we're actually, most places are unable to test for the virus, or if they are, the amount of testing is limited. So I think this is something we're going to be dealing with for a while. I don't think it's going to be catastrophic. I think a good example might be the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, it's something to take seriously, that's for sure.
That's
and
Chris.
I'm certainly taking it seriously.
Thank you, Chris Brook, assistant professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
the 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. Experts estimate there are hundreds of thousands of coyotes in our state, including in some of our most urban areas. Perhaps you've seen or heard one in your neighborhood. Nearly 100,000 coyotes were removed by professionals in 2018 alone. That's according to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Coyote attacks on people are rare, especially considering how many are in the state, but the animals are still a source of concern for many. Last week, residents in Rockford called for a public meeting about coyote sightings in which officials provided more information about the animals and tips on how best to avoid interactions with them. For more on this, we're joined by Sandy Woltman. She's the Animal Care Director for Oaken Acres Wildlife Center in Sycamore, Illinois, near DeKalb. She joins us from our partner station, WNIJ. Sandy, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Maybe I should do a howl to get going into that. Is this a new problem?
It's a more recent problem than about the last 20 years, where people seem to be more concerned having more coyote sightings in their areas. Experts believe it's due to kind of the population boom, where they've always been there and we're moving into their territory. So they're basically being forced to live closer to us.
And they're particularly attracted to those urban areas. Is there more food available?
It's pretty much a little bit of a Club Med for them. If you think about how our urban and suburban settings are, people are often leaving food outside. There's dumps and garbage outside. There's usually open water with ponds and retention ponds for subdivisions and office buildings and such. So they're very adaptable animals, and they have really learned to adapt to our suburban and urban setting.
But I have to imagine they still enjoy rural areas. Do we see them often on farmland?
We do have them often on farmland. They're not often as seen because they have more acreage to actually roam where less people are. So they're not forced to actually be living underneath our decks or underneath a porch or such, or close to a school. So they're definitely out there. They just seem to have less interactions with people.
And I'm thinking back to middle school science class and the food chain and all of that. I mean, what do they want to eat?
Coyotes are very opportunistic. They're omnivores. They'll eat food, or they'll eat meat and fruit. They typically want to prey on things like squirrels and rats and mice, even small birds. In suburban settings, they have very much taken to eating eggs out of goose nests. They've really learned to see that as a delicacy, which has actually helped to control the Canada goose population in certain counties. The last thing they're really looking for are people's pets, even though that's usually what we hear about in the uproar. They may, if there's a stray cat or a cat outside, food is food to them, and it's an easy prey source. So they may occasionally prey on something like a small cat.
Sandy, are there any misconceptions about the coyote population that you want to address?
The population has increased the last several years, again, just due to them being opportunistic in the area and really learning to adapt to the suburban and urban sprawl. Many towns, they decide to eradicate the populations of coyotes within an area, within a town, a subdivision, by removing all the coyotes that they can trap. They will hire trappers to do this. And research has actually shown that by removing coyotes, especially the females within a group, it actually increases the population. The female that is next to breed will actually have more puppies that following year than they would have had. So it's actually bad for that area in terms of it's increasing that population of coyotes.
Okay, so the easy solution, or what would seem as the easy solution, not so. Let's say someone comes across a coyote in their yard or neighborhood. I have had personal experience with this. What should they do? Obviously, it doesn't seem like a great idea to approach them.
normally we tell people just let it be. It's just passing through. Rarely does a coyote want to take up residency in someone's yard. If people just see it passing through, it's literally just passing through to get from point A to point B. There are ways to deter coyotes from being in your yard or coming closer to your homes. And that includes not leaving any food out. And that could be intentionally for your dog or cat, intentionally for things like raccoons or opossums. Food is food, and they definitely will approach and eat things like dog chow, cat chow, even open water. By leaving a water bowl out, it's going to attract coyotes to come closer to people as well. Bird feeders, you're just not feeding birds, but you're feeding the animals that will feed on the food that has fallen, such as mice and squirrels, and that's just encouraging other predatory animals, such as foxes and coyotes, to come to hunt underneath your feeders. So you may definitely see an increase in coyotes due to that.
You mentioned the it's not likely to attack small animals, but again, you keep saying, you know, food is food, and mm-hmm. cats and dogs, they're food too. But there's it's kind of the idea of driving versus flying. You know, people say, well, there's a lot of car accidents and people are afraid of flying, but flying is safer. There's millions of domesticated dog attacks each year in the U.S., and it seems like coyotes might get an unfair rep on how often that they hurt the little critters.
Yeah, there aren't millions of coyote attacks on dogs in the U.S. There's actually quite few.
But dog attacks from other sources, I guess what I'm trying to say, might be
definitely
more common than from coyotes.
Definitely. Dog bites from bites from dogs is definitely more common than something like a coyote attacking a small dog. There can be problems with your small pets, especially small dogs, that what we call the Napoleon effect, where they go out and they run at that animal. They're very small, and the coyote is kind of like, really? I can take you. Most dogs will run away from something like a coyote. They might bark at it, but they aren't going to typically challenge that coyote. We will see an increase in coyote attacks on smaller pets during certain times of the year. During breeding season, January and February is when they're out seeking mates. They're starting to really establish territory, and a canine is a canine, and they might challenge that dog if they feel it's in their territory. That's often when we will hear about coyote attacks on small animals. So we always suggest, if you have especially a small dog, to protect it as you would a small child and supervise that dog like a small child. Go out with your dog, keep it leashed, keep it close. Even a fenced yard, coyotes can scale fences and come into a yard and take a small pet. The other thing that really works well is to change up your habits. If you always let your dog out at 6 a.m., the next day let it out at 6:30. Just change up your routine every day when you're letting out your dog, so the coyote is not recognizing your routine for you. A coyote in your yard, as we said before, just it's passing from point A to B. If it is hanging out, we always recommend to do some type of hazing. You know, yell at that coyote, an air horn, banging pots and pans. You can even throw small rocks or a tennis ball or something at that animal just to get it to move on and let it know it's not welcomed in your yard.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st, and our guest is Sandy Woltman. She's the Animal Care Director for Oaken Acres Wildlife Center in Sycamore, Illinois, which is near DeKalb. She's been telling us more about coyote sightings in the northern part of the state. Sandy, can you tell us more about what your organization does to treat and care for injured coyotes?
Sure. Oaken Acres Wildlife Center is located in Sycamore, Illinois, which is in DeKalb County, so the northern part of the county. And we are a wildlife rehabilitation center caring for injured, orphaned, and diseased wildlife in DeKalb County. We typically will see coyote puppies every year that have come in that are orphaned or sick or diseased. Typically, they're orphaned due to the parents or the mother being shot and killed, or the both parents being shot and killed by someone just not wanting them on their property. Occasionally they're found on sides of roads near an injured or a killed adult. We do raise those puppies together in groups so they do not habituate or become used to people, and they are released in rural sections of DeKalb County then come fall.
And some people might think the best solution would be to catch, move them out of the area, but that's not necessarily the best idea. Can you explain what challenges that relocation poses to the animal population?
Sure. Again, we had talked about removing something like the female from a group, and then the population actually increases. Even if you were to live trap an animal and move it to a new area, an adult coyote or even a sub-adult, it's going to have challenges trying to find new territory to call its own, know its food source. Most areas within Illinois have coyotes on them already that are claiming them as their territory. So by just dumping an animal, what you think might be as a good place can actually be detrimental to that animal because it's having to fight the current coyotes that are claiming that territory.
And you mentioned
they often do not survive.
And you mentioned your organization does work to rehabilitate coyotes rather than to kill them or put them down, because I have to believe you believe that they're beneficial to the ecosystem. Can you talk more about what coyotes do provide that are some of the more positive elements for society?
Sure. Coyotes are very much rodent control in our areas, and that's all areas. Again, feeding on things like your small rodents, your rats, your mice, even squirrels, keeping those populations in check. Everything with the food chain, you're going to have predators down to prey. And your prey animals, if we weren't to have things like coyotes and foxes, they would just really overtake and become a problem. Again, in suburban areas, they're finding that coyotes have very much reduced, if not stabilized, the Canada goose population, which, if you remember, 15, 20 years ago was a huge problem within surrounding counties in northern Illinois. And the coyote population has really seemed to kind of tally that down and reduce that population, which has been great.
And they are canines, but can you describe, I know that I've heard a coyote, but I don't know if I could necessarily, sometimes it could be difficult to differentiate it from just a dog. So what makes the coyote look different than a dog?
They're all legs. Some people mistake them for a German Shepherd, but they do stand tall. They do have a long, bushy tail. They typically only weigh 30 pounds or less. So if someone sees a sick coyote, they just kind of look like all skin and bones. Their ears are typically erect. They're often seen alone or in groups of two. Oftentimes their head is down when they're lurking through something like the woods or that in line with their back. But they can very much be mistaken for something like a German Shepherd.
What tips would you have to help us coexist with one another? What should we be doing better? You talked about changing up patterns if you have pets. But I'm wondering, when trash day comes along, I have to set my trash out. Is there anything I should be doing differently?
We always recommend putting your trash out in the morning instead of the night before. Coyotes actually don't want to go to trash if they don't have to. If people have put smelly things out there, they definitely will try. And if you need to keep your trash cans outside or put it out the night before, I always recommend taking something like an old rag or a roll of toilet paper and soaking it in ammonia and putting it inside your trash can, and that often will deter a coyote from getting into the trash and moving on. But the best thing is keeping that trash can inside and not putting it out till the morning of. And that just isn't for coyotes, but things like raccoons as well that are going to be opportunistic to an easy food source.
And there was that meeting recently in Rockford. Enough people were getting fed up with seeing and hearing the coyotes that they called in the Department of Natural Resources and they did an information session. What would you say to residents who are still concerned?
I think we need to tell people that coyotes are here to stay. They're not going anywhere. They will self-limit their population once they get to certain numbers. There's not going to be enough food out there. We will not have a continually increasing population. Again, they will self-limit based on prey. And we need to change, like we said, some of our habits and just learn to coexist by not leaving food out for them. When we see them, haze them away, letting them know that they're not welcome necessarily within our yard. And just educating ourselves and our neighbors and the general public about coyotes and they're wanting to actually not be near people.
That's Sandy Woltman, the Animal Care Director for Oaken Acres Wildlife Center in Sycamore, Illinois. She's been telling us more about coyotes here in Illinois. Sandy, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Follow us on Twitter. You can search for the 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Maybe you've seen a coyote in your backyard. Share the picture. We're also on Facebook. Search for the 21st to like us, and you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you want us to ask on the air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there, and you can find us most places you get your podcast. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. The 21st is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Julian Haida. Eunice Alpazan is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hartwick is the news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Jenna Dooley. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.